that heavens declare the glory of God. I think that's what people intuitively understand. If you look at the sky and the stars, you understand there's something bigger and deeper out there, and something that you'll not be able to control or understand fully. And that's what black holes tell us as well. I mean, there's something that we cannot, at this point at least, understand. And they are, I mean, almost modern mythological objects, because they speak of the beyond. They speak of destruction. They speak of death. And that's what people, I think, intuitively, even if they're not scientists, they feel this. And so from that perspective, they are fascinated by it. Heino Falke, professor of astroparticle physics and radio astronomy at the Radboud University in Nijmegen, the Netherlands.
Welcome to Language of God. I'm Jim Stump. When the news came out that the first ever picture of a black hole had been taken, our staff all got called into the conference room. That's what happens when the president of your organization is an astronomer, as Deb Harsma is. Deb pulled up the pictures on the screen, and we talked about why this was such an amazing discovery. Heino Falke, our guest today, has been staring up at the sky since he was just a kid in Western Germany. And then fascination and the desire to see further into the darkness of space led him to be one of the leaders of the project that took that picture of a black hole. We talk about that accomplishment and other scientific topics from the book he's recently published. But Heino is also a Christian and believes not only that his faith and science do not contradict each other, but even that his regular contemplation of the mysteries of the cosmos has widened the possibilities of what his faith might mean. Let's get to the conversation. Heino Falke, it's good to have you here. Thanks for taking the time to talk to us.
Well, thanks. I'm great. I'm glad I can be here with you.
So where is here for you right now? Where are you talking to us from?
We are on the internet, aren't we? You know, it doesn't matter where we are. No, I'm actually here in a little city near Cologne, in Frechen, near Cologne, in the Rhineland area of Germany, in the west of Germany, somewhat near the Dutch border.
Well, nice. So this technological ability to talk to people in real time like this across an ocean is pretty remarkable. That's some of what we'll talk about in a bit. But first, let's get to know you a bit better, if we could. So where did you grow up? What kind of kid were you? How did you get interested in science? Give us a little autobiography in that sense.
Everything in 1 minute, I guess. No, I grew up where I am now, actually, here in Frechen. I was born in Cologne, and we moved here. My father was a doctor. He was an orthopedist.
Medical doctor.
My mother a teacher, and we grew up in a Protestant church here, which is, this is a generally Catholic area, and this church where I am at is we only have Catholic and Protestants. We are not so complicated as in the U.S. We have many different denominations. And this was one of the first in this entire area in the 1600s, actually. And that's where the Protestants were sort of still surviving. In Cologne, they couldn't. And so one part of my family has always been part of this church for a couple of hundred years, actually. It's a bit scary to think about it.
We Americans have this view of Europeans as not very interested in church these days. Was your family peculiar in that sense?
No, I think church is still part of social life in general. Of course, its influence on society is declining. It was bigger when I was young, politically, socially. But it's part of the fabric of the social society, civil society in Germany. That's certainly true.
So tell us a little bit more about your interest in science. So you said dad was a medical doctor. What were the experiences you recall as a kid that made you interested in observing the natural world and even eventually going into astronomy?
Well, the first thing I remember actually was the moon landing. It's not the first one. It was one of the last, Apollo 15. I was a little kid. I think it was 4.5 years old. And I was more or less the only one still watching it because people got bored after, you know, they already did a moon landing, you know, last year. So, you know, what's so special about it? And so all the kids were playing on the street and the parents were, you know, enjoying the sunshine. I was sitting inside watching a black and white television and seeing people running around on the moon. I was totally fascinated, flabbergasted that, you know, this would be possible. I knew this was a bizarre, enormous thing that was going on. People walking around on the moon. And so I wanted to be an astronaut. I wanted to, you know, to reach for the stars.
Mm-hmm.
And my grandmother, who grew up actually in East Prussia, what's now actually even part of the Soviet Union, of Russia, Soviet Union. It was part of Soviet Union when I was a kid. The Soviet Union doesn't exist anymore. And she had beautiful night skies, and she was growing up on a farm, and she wanted to be an astronomer as a young woman, and she wasn't allowed to because parents said, you know, you have to do something, you know, that's you know, something that's, you know, sensible, you know, not astronomy. That's nothing for a woman. But she was allowed to study. She studied English and other things, but her passion was for astronomy. So I think part of that she passed on to me a little bit. Took me to a local observatory. I saw the Saturn. I saw Saturn and the moon and so forth. That's this the first time you look through a telescope. It's always a special experience, isn't it? To see, you know, the hidden world.
Mm-hmm.
And so, but in general, I was always curious. I mean, I don't know. I can't even say that this was the defining moment. I remember myself always asking questions, you know, where is this coming from? Why is this? And generally being curious, reading a lot. And then when I was like 14, 15, I discovered the computer, right? So that's, I mean, everybody now has computers, but at the time this was really, really special. You know, your home computers would come up. Something you could, you know, this was, you know, you only had supercomputers, very fancy big things that, you know, NASA had and some of the big companies. And now they would become available. You could have them at home. And the first thing I had was like, was a programmable pocket calculator. You just, you know, would program a certain formula. Wow, you know, this thing would do what you tell it to do. And then I, you know, I talked with my parents. I want one of these, you know, Commodore VIC-20 computer. And I got it in the end because they asked me, what is this thing? What's a computer? So I had to figure it out. And I thought, yeah, that's a good thing. Okay, he'll learn something. So, okay, so I got this computer. And I really dived into it. I knew everything about the computer. Every bit and byte in this computer I knew. I printed the entire operating system, you know, decoded it, printed out onto paper. It's a big stack of paper. You could do this at the time, you know. It had a whopping 3.5 kilobyte of RAM memory. if you think about that, I think it was expanded then to 16 kilobyte, you know, if you know how little that is. But, it was just, but it was a fantastic tutor, that computer, because, you know, what you learn with computers is they do exactly what you tell them to do. I mean, that may not be your experience today with a computer, right? They do their own thing. But these computers were simple enough. So, you know, whatever they did was what you programmed them to do, what you told them to do. They don't do what you think they should do. They do what you tell them to do. That's what programming is. And so every error, you know, that the computer makes is your own error. It's because you didn't communicate properly with the computer. You didn't tell it exactly what you meant. And so that teaches to be very precise, to always question yourself, because, you know, every time I got upset, you know, tried to throw the computer into whatever, the bin, it was my fault. You know, it was me not, you know, formulating things properly. And you know, that was, I think, one of my best teachers. And ever since, I've been using a computer for, you know, everything I do in science. I try to automize everything I did in science. I did it by hand typically, but then I always had the computer, you know, redo this.
So by the time you got to university, were you pretty well on this track toward astronomy and the computerized automated world that has become?
Well, it wasn't that automized yet. I was one of the, in the first semester, I was one of the first to actually use computers for their data analysis. That wasn't so widespread. People would still, you know, write things down in columns on paper with a pencil. And I was using the computer. And I wasn't quite clear in my mind what I wanted to do, because I was fascinated with particle physics as well. You know, I was interested in the fundamental questions. I wanted to do fundamental science, the deep questions, where, you know, where's something new to discover. And that was either particle physics, because that was, you know, really booming in the 70s, 80s, in the last century, really. But I recognized astrophysics is also interesting. I mean, there's so many new discoveries being made, new telescopes being built, new insights, and every time there was something new happening in astronomy. It's really just beginning of the golden age of astronomy. And I could feel that. And you could feel that. I don't want to insult any particle physicists, but you could feel mm-hmm. that particle physics, you know, was going to face a long period of hard work, of, you know, maybe not so exciting results. Because, you know, a lot of things had already happened. And you had to build bigger accelerators and much bigger teams in astronomy. You know, individual people could make, you know, new discoveries and find new things. And what I also realized was that, you know, already then black holes started to fascinate me, because what I understood was that if you think about a theory of everything, you know, that was a big thing at the time, you know, the theory, the equation of everything, the theory of everything. And the, you know, we had an understanding of particle physics and other things, but gravity was resisting. That was the one source, one force we didn't understand well. Because we couldn't rhyme it with quantum physics. That was already clear in the 80s and 90s. So I thought, well, that's interesting. So there is a really fundamental theory here, theory of gravitation, of general relativity of Albert Einstein, that describes our world. Well, it seems to work well. We have quantum physics, seems to work well. But they don't work together. We don't have a theory of quantum gravity yet. And where this, you know, is most obvious and happening is near black holes. So in my mind, black holes were already, you know, very fundamental for understanding physics.
Good. Let's get to your book here a little bit. Light in the Darkness, Black Holes, the Universe, and Us. It came out in German last year and translated into English, published at Harper One this year. I just had a read through it this last week. People in your discipline, I think, primarily apply their writing skills to technical articles for peer-reviewed journals. What was the experience like for writing a book like this for the general public?
It was actually a joy to write. I must say, it was my first book I wrote, and it happened actually at the beginning of the Corona pandemic. So I was like halfway through, and the pandemic struck, and many things were canceled. So I had a lot of time to actually focus on the book. I had reserved time for it, and being able to tell a story. And to write your story in a book was really a pleasure. And of course, I do have some experience. I've been, which we haven't mentioned yet. I'm also a lay minister in our church. So I'm used to tell sermons. So to you know, give sermons. I've been, you know, giving public lectures for 30 years of my life, you know, going to little churches, to amateur astronomer clubs, whatever. So I'm used to tell stories. And that's what you also learn at church, in fact, you know, tell stories. And writing down your own story and mixing that with the story of science, the way you've got to know it, of course, was wonderful. You create, you know, it's you don't create a fantasy world, right? So that because you try to describe reality, but you can, you know, this book is the world that you've experienced, and you can write it down and tell the story. And of course, you know, at some point also that gets hard when you have to cut things out, or it would have been almost bigger, and the publisher said, no, that's getting too long, you know, you're telling too many stories, you know, cut them out here. too many jokes. No, not so many jokes. It's a German book. And I was working together with a professional journalist. It was really a collaboration, which is something you learn in science, in fact. You know, if you write an article, I mean, you just don't write an article. You constantly get comments, and some people say, oh, that's crap, you know, take out this. And it's constantly revised. I mean, you have to have a lot of patience these days to write a scientific article, because everybody has an opinion, you know, all your collaborators. And then the referee comes and so forth. So you know, an article is never done. You polish it, you rewrite it. And so being prepared to work with the publisher, with a co-author, that was new to me. In fact, it was much easier than writing a scientific article.
Well, one of the very nice features of your book is that it situates this achievement of producing a photograph of a black hole, or at least the shadow of a black hole. We'll get to that in a minute. But it situates that against the backdrop of the historical development of astronomy and cosmology. And I think it's hard to overstate the really remarkable change, the revolution, really, in our picture of the universe and our place in it that's occurred over the last century or maybe 115 years we go back now. Can you give us just a taste of what we know about the universe now that we didn't at the beginning of the 20th century?
Well, think about 1915. That's when Albert Einstein developed general relativity. We had a universe that was, not even the size of our Milky Way, that was static, that existed since eternity and would keep existing for eternity. Space and time were absolute. Everything was determined. You know, the universe was like a clockwork. If you just would know a little better, we could exactly predict how the universe would be, what you would think perhaps in the future. I don't know. You could predict where the stars, where the planets are, but also how, you know, machines, how, you know, the entire state of the universe would develop. And then, you know, Albert Einstein came along and showed that time and space are relative. They don't have that. They're not absolute things that exist by themselves in a way. They're only the ones that we measure, and we can measure them differently. Then we discover, you know, the mathematical solution of black holes by Karl Schwarzschild just a few months later. And then, you know, David Hilbert, a mathematician, calculates how light is bent around a black hole. Light can go around in circles. And we find that light could actually disappear with all information in black holes and never come back. You know, people think, oh, that's just crazy. You know, it's just theory. Astronomers start to look at the universe. They figure out, well, there is more out there. It's not just this galaxy. There are other things out there. Maybe they are galaxies. Maybe they are like our own galaxy. And, you know, 10 years later in the 20s, they find that's true, actually. They are galaxies. Our universe is much bigger than just our own galaxy, our Milky Way. And then they figure out, in fact, it was a Catholic priest, that the universe is expanding. And according to the theory of Albert Einstein, that universe couldn't be static. If you just apply the calculations, then either this universe is collapsing or it has to be expanding. Or you need some mysterious force to keep it just right. And so the universe should be dynamic, and the universe would have a beginning. You know, what a radical thought. You know, people like Einstein and Eddington, famous physicists, they just hated that thought. You know, the universe would have a beginning. And then you have quantum physics, which is even weirder, which tells you, you can't even know the state of every object because, you know, it's just, you know, to some degree random. Yeah, you certain things you just can never measure precisely enough. And then even later you have quantum chaos theory, which tells you can't even predict everything. Even if you measure everything precisely, you cannot even predict where in 20 million years exactly the Earth will be on its orbit. So the universe, from being completely understood, from being, you know, predestined, being determined, being in a way boring, becomes something that you know, started at some point, becomes unpredictable at some level, becomes where time, space are changing, where there are limits to our knowledge. You know, the Big Bang, which is, you know, doesn't tell us, it doesn't allow us to look into the beginning of the universe. You know, we don't know where it's coming from. We have black holes. We look into where you know we can't know what's happening inside. We cannot predict the future over long time scales, at least not for individual particles. Our worldview has completely changed. And I think many of more, you know, traditional Christians are fighting the signs of the 19th century rather than having understood that the 20th century has completely changed that picture.
Yeah, that's interesting. So 1915, we thought we were in a cozy little universe about the size, smaller, you say, even than what we understand the Milky Way to be.
Yeah.
What can you tell us about the size we believe the universe to be now?
Well, I think the visible universe is about 80 billion light years across. The Milky Way itself, if we look to the center of our Milky Way, we know very exactly it's about 27,000 light years. Mm. That we're looking into the past as well and into the distance. We're looking at Andromeda Milky Way, the Andromeda galaxy, at about 3 million light years away. It's something you can still see with your naked eye. That's how far your eye can see. It can look, you know, a few million years in the past by looking at the Andromeda galaxy. And then we are looking at the quasars, supermassive black holes in the early universe, billions of light years away that we see. And our universe has expanded. And that, you know, if you go back to, let me just mention the closest, you know, the moon. I was talking about light years. The moon is a light second away. Yeah, and the most nearby, the planets are light hours away. The sun is 8 light minutes away. The stars are, you know, a few years to a few thousand years away. Well, and then you go, you know, out all the way to the farthest galaxy in the universe, millions, tens of millions, billions of light years.
Well, let's talk a little bit about black holes here now. Can you give us a sort of crash course on what black holes are? You said they were first posited as a sort of mathematical abstraction or a solution to a mathematical problem. Tell us a little bit more about that. Why were these things posited? What led to the positing that there is such a thing? And give us a little bit more about what they are exactly.
They were posited because it was the most simple thing to calculate. To be frank, when Albert Einstein's theory came out, Schwarzschild calculated, okay, how would space and time look like around an object where all the mass is just the size of a point? It's not even extended. It's just everything in a single point. And every physicist knows that this is essentially a mathematical trick, right? It's just something that makes your calculations easier. And Einstein said, you know, this couldn't exist. And why did he say that? Because when you calculate this situation where all the mass is in one point, then you find that the curvature of space and time becomes infinite, the attraction, the gravitational attraction becomes infinite, and becomes so strong that nothing can ever escape due to the force of gravity. In fact, even if you go away from this point, at a certain distance, which we call the Schwarzschild radius now, because, you know, he was the first to calculate it. If he, and that's about 3 kilometers for this a black hole the mass of the sun, then even light would not be able to escape still at that distance from that point source. And that means that not even light can escape. No form of information can ever escape. Nothing can escape. No matter, no light, no matter what you do. And that would mean that there would be a region of space that's inaccessible to scientific investigation, because you need to measure, you need to observe for something to be real. And that is a bizarre thought. Mm. You know, if you'd had such an object, it would for sure be real because you'd feel its gravitational attraction very far out still. But the region directly surrounding it, you know, you would not be able to measure, fundamentally never be able to measure and see. So Einstein said, this can't exist. You know, these things never
And there
form.
Was no empirical evidence for these things at that time,
At
right?
that time, absolutely no. No, absolutely no evidence. Except that a few years later, Heber Curtis, an American astronomer, it looked at this nebula called M87, which later became famous because we took the mm-hmm. first image of a black hole
we'll get back to
in
that.
This galaxy. Yeah. At that time, people didn't even know this was a galaxy, right? They didn't know this was 55 million light years away. They didn't know this were, you know, thousands of billions of stars. They didn't know it had a black hole in the center. And he saw a little streak of light coming out of the very center. And we now know this is a plasma jet, you know, where hot gas is shooting out with almost the speed of light, and it's accelerated by the black hole. He knew nothing of that. He just saw this little streak of light in his photograph, so to speak. And it was pointing towards a supermassive black hole, but nobody knew. So you had the theorists, you know, developing the theory of black holes, so to speak, purely mathematical. You had an astronomer seeing something there, and it was pointing to where the theory was real, and they didn't really know. You know, it took decades to figure out that these things had anything in common.
Hmm. Well, according to the well-developed, confirmed theories you work with now, about how common are black holes? How many would we expect to find in our galaxy, say?
They are widespread, and there are two different types of black holes. There are the stellar ones, so that they come out of the end stages of stars. When the star has used up all its fuel, then there's no pressure anymore, no heat anymore to keep it up, and it will collapse. And in that collapse, if the star is really big, the pressure in the inside becomes so big, the density becomes so high, that gravity becomes so strong that will keep pulling everything together. I mean, there will be counter pressure all the way through, like normal pressure, okay? But gravity will win. And so that object in the center of a star will collapse forever. And so we think there are about hundreds of millions of stellar mass black holes coming out of these super explosions that, you know, roam around our own Milky Way.
Wow.
And again, you have sort of hundreds of billions of galaxies throughout the entire universe. But then in the very center of each galaxy, where you have the highest density of stars, you know, where here we have one star, namely our sun, in the very center of the Milky Way, we have millions of stars. And so there'll be lots of, you know, smaller black holes forming, and they will sink towards the center, and they will merge, and they form a big black hole. And a black hole can only grow. Black hole can never shrink, at least if Einstein is correct. We'll talk about Hawking radiation maybe later. But, you know, in principle, a black hole only knows one direction, you know, get bigger. And it will keep growing. And the biggest one will go towards the center and will, you know, assume and you know, will accrete and will merge with many others, and will just, you know, eat the rest, so to speak, and become bigger and bigger and bigger. And so in the very centers of galaxies, you have these supermassive black holes in our Milky Way, million times the mass of the sun. And then, you know, in M87, this galaxy I just mentioned, it's about 6 billion times the mass of the sun.
6 billion times the mass of our sun.
6 billion suns have fallen into that galaxy, into that black hole.
And then the issue with the black hole in our own, at the center of our galaxy, is that it's shrouded in various kinds of dust, and that makes the image more difficult to get. Is that correct?
The radio emission is a little bit corrupted as it traveled through the Milky Way, through, you know, ionized plasma and so forth. Luckily, at this high frequencies that we observe them with, that effect starts to, you know, decrease substantially. So if you look at lower frequencies, you will not see the structure of this source. And we hope that by going to the high frequencies that we do our measurements with, we actually can beat that effect, that it becomes smaller and smaller. But it's, you know, still makes it, you know, a tough experiment to do.
Yeah, let's talk about that a little bit. So first, M87, which direction are we looking? If we were to look out at the night sky, which direction should we be looking if we actually wanted to face where M87 is?
Well, the easiest is to go to a star chart and look for the constellation of Virgo. It's in the Virgo cluster. And that's the closest cluster of galaxies in the universe, the closest cluster of you know, hundreds of thousands of galaxies that are nearby to our own galaxy. And it depends on, of course, what time of the year you look, where you will see it.
Well, if anybody thinks the process of snapping a picture of a black hole like this is simply getting a really big telescope and pointing it in the right direction, and the black hole appears in the viewfinder, like what happened for you as a kid looking at Saturn and the moon, they're going to be in for a surprise, right? Tell us about the telescope, or rather the system of telescopes you had to use to image M87.
Well, it's sort of easy. All you need is a telescope the size of the Earth, right? if you have that, you know, it's no problem. Since we don't have that, we have to build it somehow, and we have to use a trick. We don't use a, you know, entire mirror that covers the entire Earth. I guess we would get in trouble with some people if we do that. So instead, we use only, you know, small telescopes distributed over the world, which already exist, and we couple them digitally via computers, and we record the radio waves essentially hitting the radio telescope there. And then, you know, what a big telescope would do, a big telescope would just, you know, the mirror would reflect the waves and then would bring it together in the focus, right? You have to focus every telescope where the light, you know, is bundled and brought together in one point. And that focus would be, you know, way above the Earth in our, you know, telescope. So what we do is we actually store the radio light on hard drives. We record the light in the computer, and this focusing, bringing together, we do in the computer, and so we synthesize a world-sized telescope by combining many little telescopes. Every telescope looks under a slightly different angle, brings its own perspective, and by, you know, bringing these different perspectives together from the entire world, we can actually measure the structure and make an actual image.
Listeners, on this podcast, we hear a lot of stories of young people who consider leaving the church because of the tensions they find between science and faith. It doesn't have to be that way. That's why we developed Integrate, a teaching resource designed for classroom teachers and home educators. It seeks to equip the next generation of Christian leaders to be faithful, informed, and gracious voices engaging with the hard questions raised by science. To learn more, just go to biologos.org/integrate. All right, back to the conversation.
Well, one of the, I think, really enlightening aspects of your book is the glimpse that it gives us into what the life of a professional astronomer is really like. You had about 10 days set aside for the actual observation and data collection, and you could only observe for about 5 of those because of weather, but all of this was years and years in the making to get to that point. And it wasn't all just science, right? There's a lot of raising money and persuading bureaucracies. And you had challenges like earthquakes and supply chain fiascos and even armed bandits in one time, right?
Absolutely.
How much of your time is actually doing the science itself?
Yeah, good question. It took 25 years for me from the first idea. And you have to do it together. So half of the, you know, the work is, well, maybe most of the work is actually A, convincing your colleagues this is worth doing, this is realistic, that makes sense. Then, you know, finding the right team to work on this. And then it has to happen internationally. And, you know, astronomers a little bit like you know, lone cowboys sometimes. They do their thing in a little band. Now we have to, you know, band together in a big group, which is really transcending nations and cultures even. We have, you know, people from Asia, from Africa, from Latin America, from Europe, from Africa. All this collaboration, they have to work together. So the sociological challenges are, diplomatic, political ones are sometimes as large as the technical ones. Yeah, it's everything. It really, and that makes science sometimes also so fascinating, of course. It's not just sitting in your office and you know, with a pen of paper and thinking about things. I mean, that's, you know, some theorists still do this. But really, this is the entire spectrum, from understanding the technology to understanding the algorithms, from developing some of those, managing a team, you know, diplomatic negotiations, finding the funding, you know, going into competitions to really get the funding. You know, one of the, we got a huge funding from the European Union, and that had a chance when we put it in of 1.5% to succeed. So, you know, if you do this, you just get, you know, go paranoid when you prepare your proposal. You know, it has to be really, everything has to be perfect.
So this is a very human endeavor in all aspects of being human.
And I can tell you it's even more human than I write in the book. You know, I didn't write everything. So it's...
Okay, so you have all these telescopes now looking at the exact same spot of the sky at precisely the same time, and they're collecting all the data, 450 terabytes of data from each of these 8 telescopes. Then it takes 9 months and a bunch of grad students and postdocs to sift out from all the static the information you're looking for, and that's what ultimately then produces this image.
If you sum it up briefly, you know, some of these hard drives were on the South Pole. You know, our colleagues in in Chicago and Arizona, they actually had equipped a telescope in the South Pole, and the and it takes, you know, an entire night. You can't travel during the night from the South Pole, and the night takes half a year, right? So that means the data takes a while until it comes back. And then you have to figure out all the issues. I mean, I always say, you know, also telescope is only human, because, you know, every telescope has its own personality, its own problems. It's, you know, which you need to sort out to understand the data, and you combine it, and then you see the very first time, you know, the combination of everything, and it's not yet an image. Just a graphics on your computer. And in fact, indeed, it was my PhD student, Sarah Isaun, who's now going to Harvard as a Hubble Fellow, who showed me the first data that we had collected, preliminarily calibrated. And it was just, you know, a curve. It wasn't an image. But you could see, boy, that looks really interesting. That's something. We you know, this is, you know, looks like a dream result. And that's a special
moment. Why is
that?
What do you mean by that? What was your reaction to seeing the graph data that was so remarkable?
You have to do a mathematical transformation in your head, but, you know, you're trained to do this as a radio astronomer, and it looked like a ring. And when we usually observe black holes, we see this plasma streak, right? So this a line, so to speak, something shooting out. Like a smoke trail. This is what we usually see. We usually never see a ring. We never see a ring when we look at black holes. But this time we saw a ring. And that was exactly what we expected if we would look really at a black hole. If you get close to a black hole, light would be going around in a circle around the black hole. And in the center, you would not see a bright object. You would see darkness. You would see the darkness of the event horizon. And even though it was an image, in my mind already an image was forming, and it looked very, very promising. And then, you know, we may be looking at something that nobody's ever seen before. We're looking at a world nobody had ever, never, you know, approached. We are the first to set eye on the most bizarre point in space and time in our universe.
What do you learn from the photograph that you didn't know on strictly mathematical grounds?
Oh, mathematically, it confirms what the math was predicting. But of course, you know, we never know whether math is reality. It's a physicist's job to figure out, you know, which ones of these mathematical predictions are represent a real world and which ones are just, you know, fantasy, so to speak, or just abstract, or just mathematics. And so for the first time, we really see that supermassive black holes really behave as black holes. They seem to have, you know, they can bend light to go in circles. You see the darkness of the event horizon. So for all practical purposes, we can say, you know, supermassive black holes really exist as predicted. You also learn how the stuff around it is behaving. I mean, this is bizarre astrophysics. The gas gets hundreds of billion degrees hot. There are strong magnetic fields. Some of them can even launch these plasma jets and shoot them out again. So not all the matter that falls into a black hole or falls towards a black hole will end up in the black hole. A lucky few percent, are able to escape with those magnetic field lines. So I always tell, you know, if I give a talk, I tell people, you know, if there's one thing you learn today is if you fall into a black hole, make sure you know, hold on to a magnetic field line. And that, you know, gives you a chance to escape. It's only 3% chance, but better than nothing, right? So
I don't want to denigrate pure knowledge for the sake of knowing and the pleasure that that brings, but is there any sort of application to the knowledge that you've gained about black holes, or this one in particular, 55 million light years away? Why is it important that we learn how these things behave and what they are and how they operate?
But my first answer always is, it is because we're curious, because we want to know, because right. We want to know what's happening at the limits of our knowledge. We want to see, you know, we want to see where we can't go any further. And we've reached those points now. We've looked at the beginning of the universe. We're looking towards the Big Bang. We know, you know, there's a wheel that's covering the beginning. We get further. And then we see the darkness of the event horizon. We know, you know, up till here and what's happening behind, we cannot measure. And so we've gone as far as you can go, you know, where nobody has gone before and where nobody else will be able to come back from in the future. Of course, what we want to learn is whether eventually, you know, quantum physics and gravity, you know, whether there's a theory that describes them. And for the first time in the history of humankind, we have experiments that can measure at the region where it's happening. We have this gravitational waves measurements now where we can actually listen to black holes, so to speak, how they emerge and form. And we can see black holes with the event horizon telescopes and see how they look. So hopefully this gives us a new theory of space and time and matter. What that will give you in terms of stock market, where you should invest in which company, maybe it'll take 100 years or more. But I give you the example of GPS that we're using today. GPS only works because general relativity is understood, and because the Earth actually makes time go slower here on the surface compared to a satellite in space. So we have to correct for that based on the theory of relativity. And without Albert Einstein's theory, GPS wouldn't work or wouldn't be understood. Why did that come about? Because people were curious. There was no technological, you know, reason to develop general relativity in 1915. It was able to explain a very subtle effect in the orbit of Mercury around the sun. Yeah, something nobody cared about except for a few astronomers. And it was really tiny little deviation from the theory. That was it. But this was enough to really change entirely the way we think about space and time in our universe. And it made, you know, your car navigation possible in the end.
Well, so you released the image of this black hole, and it really created quite a stir. I read something like the billions of people that saw this and were amazed, had a sort of awe-inspiring reaction to it. Why is it that you think an image of a black hole can evoke this, or maybe even cosmology, astrophysics in general seems to evoke a sense of awe and wonder and even provoke ultimate questions about the meaning of life?
Yeah, well, the heavens declare the glory of God. I think that's what people intuitively understand. If you look at the sky, at the stars, you understand there's something bigger and deeper out there, and something that you'll not be able to control or understand fully. And that's what black holes tell us as well. I mean, there's something that we cannot, at this point at least, understand. And they are, I mean, almost modern mythological objects, because they speak of the beyond, they speak of destruction, they speak of death. And that's what people, I think, intuitively, even if they're not scientists, that they feel this. And so from that perspective, they are fascinated by it. I mean, it's like the, you know, I call them the dinosaurs. All the kids are fascinated by dinosaurs, right? And, you know, in astrophysics, the black holes are, so to speak, the dinosaurs. Everybody's fascinated by them, but you know, just because of what they are, not necessarily because of the science. But here it both comes together, the you know, this intuitive feeling and the fundamental science that we still have to learn at their edge.
Well, in the last chapter of your book, you bring up religion more specifically, and I will maybe might get you to comment on a couple of these aspects just in the closing part of our conversation. I really like how you explain there that science can't answer all the most important questions we humans have. For example, science became so successful by adopting the language of mathematics, but there are lots of things that don't really admit a mathematical treatment. So you say, the language of mathematics gives me no insight into questions like whether I am loved or what I am worth. And I think this really adds an element of humility to our search for knowledge. But then you go on to say a couple of interesting, maybe even provocative things that I'd like to get your thoughts on. The first of these, you say, I don't think that a completely godless physics is possible, not if you're truly asking questions that go right to the limits of human knowledge and then continue beyond these limits. And then you go on to address what's sometimes called a God of the gaps problem, according to which people sometimes claim that God was merely used to fill in the gaps in our understanding, that we no longer have need for that. On the contrary, you say, I say that today God is more necessary than ever. The gap of unknowing that God is meant to fill has become larger and more fundamental than it ever was. What do you mean by those claims?
We have used the entire arsenal of science, of technology, to go really to, you know, the extremes of the cosmos, trying to understand everything, trying to predict everything. And we are extremely successful. Let there be no question about it. Science works. Science is important. And I believe that actually, as a Christian, I believe that also God speaks also through science. So you have to listen to through science. But the ultimate question, the hope that you really can explain every question, and the most fundamental question, where does everything come from? Why is it that it works? That ultimate question has become just even more mysterious, more wonderful, so to speak, right? You suddenly start with a few natural laws and some quantum chaos, a tohu bavohu. I don't know whether that's an English word. That's sort of the ancient sort of sea, the ocean of nothingness that existed before the world was created, the ancient chaos, so to speak. And then, with a few natural laws, and I say in the book also, to me, the laws of nature also, it's also a word of God, right? If you look at Genesis, God spoke. That's the first thing that happened. And then out of this, an entire universe emerges where life is possible and everything. This is miraculous, so to speak. It's natural. We can describe how it works, but the sheer fact that it works is totally amazing. And it looks like, I think, we'll never be able, well, I'm pretty, confident, we'll never be able to explain why this works. Because you could say, people say, okay, maybe there are multiple universes. We just happen to live in the one universe that that works, right? So it's a. But then, where do these multiple universes come from? The question just becomes bigger, in a sense. It becomes more. We can picture someone, crafting every little detail of the Earth, as we craft things. But someone just saying a word with a few. you know, natural laws, and out of this comes such a complex, wonderful earth with life and thoughts and songs and stories and everything emerges from just a few words. The basic equations of this universe we can write down on a few pages. And that's all we need. And this is just, you know, mind-boggling to think about.
So astrophysics is often fertile ground for theistic arguments, fine-tuning that you refer to there, the incredible narrowness of many of these parameters within which life can even exist. The Big Bang itself, often referred to as an uncaused cause, it's at least in the language of Thomas Aquinas. You mention at the time of the discovery of an acceptance of Big Bang that the scientific community wasn't exactly thrilled about this, thinking that, and the phrase you use, thinking that it lets the creator jump right back out of the coffin. Mm-hmm. Has there been any widespread return to theism among professional astrophysicists as a result of these discoveries?
No, I don't think that has caused it, because I don't believe in that you can prove God through, you know, logic reasoning. You can show that God is a very sensible thing to live with, but I don't believe you can prove God through science or logic, because you can always make another argument, and that's you always have to believe something. You have to believe God doesn't exist or God exists. You can say, you know, this fine tuning that which is miraculous. You know, the fact that it works is just, you know, wonderful. But you could always say it's just coincidence. Yeah, it just happened to be. Okay, and that's how we can look at the world. You can say just everything that happens to me. It just, you know, it's just coincidence. It just happens to me. Someone loves me. Oh, it just happens. It's just coincidence. Or you can say there's a purpose. Oh, this world has a purpose. It is because, you know, there is a God that wanted that world to be there. I'm here because I'm loved. I have a place here. God, you know, wants me to be here. Or you can say, I'm just totally random coincidence. I'm just lucky. And that is a pure choice. That is faith. It's nothing you can prove scientifically. But on the other hand, let me just tell one more story. I was in Leuven. This is a Belgian university city. And that's where the Big Bang was actually discovered by a priest, a Catholic priest, Georges Lemaître. He was very well educated. He was at all the places. He was at, you know, in Princeton. He was traveling through the U.S. and Caltech. He was talking with Albert Einstein, with all the leading physicists of his days. And he was the first to realize that, you know, A, the equations of Albert Einstein have another solution, namely an expanding universe as well. Einstein was worried about the collapse, but he was thinking exactly the opposite. It could be expanding. And he had known about the galaxies, you know, that were measured at the time, and with just a very new result that they were expanding. So he came up with this idea that the universe could have had a beginning. And I just saw, like, a few weeks ago, this first graph he made of the expanding universe. He was the only person at the day that had this, you know, that knew this. And he wrote down T equals zero, you know, at the bottom of a graph. You know, the time had a beginning. That was a beginning. And, you know, and literally, you know, Einstein and Eddington and others were just, you know, saying this is repugnant. It's just, you know, literally they said that. It's just, you know, because you're just saying this because you want to defend your Catholic faith or your faith in general. That makes me, even by the way, even more angry that Christians today, you know, don't, you know, fight the Big Bang. You know, it's even though this is, you know, as one colleague said, you know, science of the 20th century has proven, you know, the first three words of the Bible to be correct. In the beginning, there was a beginning. You have to remember what a radical thought that was. But then in a little article that he wrote to Nature, Lemaître said, and actually there was a final paragraph when he was, you know, defending on physical grounds the Big Bang theory, which wasn't called Big Bang at the time. he wrote a theological thinking, and he crossed it out. He didn't send it to the journal in the end, but it's in the original manuscript. He said if he, I don't know it, you know, literally, but what a relief it is to us believers, you know, those of us who believe that there is a supreme being, that this supreme being is shielded by a wheel of, that physics doesn't reach that point. You cannot use physics to describe God. Yeah, physics ends at this point, T equals zero, so to speak. And God is beyond that. God is beyond physics. And that was so, you have to imagine the time you were living in. You were afraid that physics would describe the beginning and the end. Everything was determined. And you could just calculate God, so to speak. God was a watchmaker who had nothing to do with his world. And physics told you then, that's not true. There is a, you know, a wheel of secrecy, of darkness, of you know, of you not getting any further. The secret of God remains. You cannot uncover God with physics or math or logic or whatever.
Well, I think it's pretty exciting to think about the fact that physics has explained so much that perhaps we never thought was possible, but at the same time has shown that there will probably always be areas that physics will never be able to explain, that there is something beyond that. And our time is up here, but I thank you so much for talking to us. Achievement is pretty remarkable for your career. Anything else on the horizon that's next that may compete with it? What are you looking to do next?
You're never satisfied, are you? No, we've been looking at one black hole. We're looking at more. We're still looking at the center of the Milky Way. It's still a very exciting confirmation and even a better test of general relativity. And of course, we want to understand. We want to understand how the astrophysics works around black holes, what's happening there. We want to understand how gravity and quantum physics goes together. I think we're just beginning in a way.
Well, very good. The book, again, is called Light in the Darkness, Black Holes, the Universe, and Us. I recommend it, and I hope that you might write another one. We might talk again someday about what it is that you discover next.
Yes. I already have some ideas.
Good. Well, thanks so much, Heino Falke, for talking to us.
Thank you for having me.
Language of God is produced by BioLogos. It has been funded in part by the John Templeton Foundation, the Fetzer Institute, and by individual donors who contribute to BioLogos. Language of God is produced and mixed by Colin Hugerwerf, that's me. Nate Mulder is our assistant producer, and our theme song is by Breakmaster Cylinder. BioLogos offices are located in Grand Rapids, Michigan, in the Grand River watershed. If you have questions or want to join in a conversation about this episode, find a link in the show notes for the BioLogos forum, or visit our website, biologos.org, where you'll find articles, videos, and other resources on faith and science. Thanks for listening.